Dakota has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
Due to the themes of this podcast, listener discretion is advised. Lock your doors, close the blinds, change your passwords. This is Secrets and Spies. Secrets and Spies is a podcast that dives into the world of espionage, terrorism, geopolitics, and intrigue. This episode is presented by Matt Fulton and produced by Chris Carr.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Secrets and Spies. In the early 2000s, a quiet engineer in Southern California was living what looked like a textbook American immigrant success story. He owned a modest home, went to work every day at a defense contractor supporting the U.S. Navy, and kept a low profile. His name was G-Mac. For decades, he had access to some of the most sensitive technologies in the U.S. submarine fleet. Behind that ordinary facade, the FBI eventually concluded, Mac and his family were at the center of one of the most prolific Chinese espionage operations ever uncovered on American soil. Today's guest, former FBI Special Agent Jim Gaylord, led the multi-year investigation that brought Mac and his co-conspirators down. His new book, Chasing Chi, is a rare insider account of what it actually takes to hunt a spy inside the United States, how it works, how quickly it can all go wrong, and just how much patience and luck are involved. We'll talk about how the case unfolded, what it revealed about China's approach to stealing American technology, and what it tells us about the threat landscape we're facing today, from intellectual property theft to pre-positioned malware and critical infrastructure. And we'll end with a harder question. If a real crisis with China emerges, how prepared are we, psychologically and practically, for that fight to come home? Thanks for listening. Thanks for watching. Take care.
The opinions expressed by guests on Secrets and Spies do not necessarily represent those of the producers and sponsors of this podcast.
Jim, welcome to Secrets and Spies. It's such a pleasure to have you with us finally.
Thanks, Matt. Been looking forward to it.
Yeah. So you're here today because you've written a new book, Chasing Chi, which pulls back the curtain on the investigation you led for the FBI into Chinese spy Chi Mac, one of the most consequential espionage cases uncovered on U.S. soil. It's an extraordinary story about patience, tradecraft, and how China goes after American technology. But before we get into the book and the case itself, I'd love to start with you. So You spent a big chunk of your FBI career in counterintelligence. What pulled you into that world in the first place? And once you got there, what most surprised you about what the work was actually like?
Well, when I got into the Bureau, I hadn't decided whether it's criminal. I don't think I even considered the counterintelligence side of it, although I was a huge, not a fan. I took in a lot about the Cold War, so I guess you'd call me a Cold Warrior. When I joined the Bureau, basically the decision was kind of made for me because my first office was Minneapolis, and after that, everyone from Minneapolis was going to go to New York, and they weren't paying COLA back then. So agents were living way on the outskirts to get into New York, and it was a horrible commute. Mm-hmm. I heard about it, and I saw an availability to take Vietnamese, learn it, and then go to Orange County, California. I'm from Southern California, so I put in for that. I ended up over 2.5 years learning Vietnamese, and I worked in Little Saigon, and it was all counterintelligence, and I loved it. I loved it, and besides Vietnamese, I'd also worked in China and Russia and Iran and the others, and that I kind of backed into it, and once I'd started, I loved the work. And that's basically how I became went into counterintelligence. By 2001, I was also working counterterrorism, because our squad handled both Orange County. And by 2001, the Vietnamese target had kind of died down, and China was the huge concern. And so I started working a lot of Chinese cases.
So when you're running a CI case, how does that differ from a traditional criminal investigation in how you build evidence, the timelines you're working on, and the kind of risks that you're managing?
Well, criminal can be a lot more out there. Most of the work for counterintelligence, the vast majority of it is classified. So you're not going to judges. You're not going to prosecutors. You're on your own as far as it's just the Bureau, no other agencies other than other counterintelligence agents, CIA and NSA and such. But you're working that, and you're doing the best you can to typically you get a lead, and you're not sure if it's true or not. This person's working, or there's some working for another government, or there's some indication they're taking things from work, or they're trying to influence a local community like the Vietnamese community. And so you're looking at it. You can go and interview people, kind of get their gist of what this person's all about. Is it true or not? You do record checks. I did lots of trash covers, because you get a lot of stuff going through people's trash. You get a lot of tidbits people throw out. And you're trying to figure out if this person's an agent. And if they are, do you have the evidence that's not classified? But normally you can't bring classified evidence in a court unless you get it declassified. That's a lot of work, and it's an uphill battle. So you're trying to figure out they're an agent. And if you can't prosecute them, how else are you going to neutralize their effectiveness? Maybe you go and interview their employer and the people around them that they're getting information from or trying to influence. Maybe they're here illegally, or they've overstayed their visa, in which case I'd contact ICE and try to get them deported, things like that. But there's no clear-cut solution normally like there is in criminal case, which is either up or down. Do we have the evidence?
So over the course of your career, when did China start to move from one of several players that you're focused on in CI to the dominant counterintelligence concern? And how did that show up in the cases coming across your desk at the Bureau?
Well, in the 80s, it was all Russia. Mm-hmm. And then once the 90s came and the Clinton administration came and China started its influence operations in the United States, that's when I first became aware that this country's a problem. And once they started becoming a commercial rival in the United States, and that's when we started seeing a lot more of them, students and diplomats and businessmen coming over and trying to take information, technical information, now that their economy was up to the ability to copy and duplicate and try to surpass our industries. So that's in the 90s is when I first noticed them coming on, and the Bureau as a whole noticed this. And then once we got towards the end of the 90s, we started having cases pop up, cases that ended up failing, usually because of prosecutors and the United States Attorney's Office locally or the Department of Justice just didn't have a stomach for going after these subjects. And so there was failure after failure, but we knew that was the major threat, that they had surpassed the Soviet Union as the major intelligence threat to the United States.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess that kind of leads nicely into the subject of the book we're talking about. So for listeners who may have only have a vague memory of those headlines from, well, approaching 20 years ago now, or have never heard of this case, who was Chemack as you first understood him, this quiet engineer and a Navy contractor? And why did this particular case matter so much once you started to peel it back?
Well, we had a very vague leak about there being a leak out of a facility in Anaheim called Power Paragon. We didn't know it was Chemack at the time. So the way we tracked him down was we knew what technologies were being stolen, and we narrowed it down to just a few people that were possibilities. And then Chemack, it turned out, was traveling to China, and in fact was in China when we started the investigation. And once we narrowed it down further onto him, we started getting all sorts of affirmations that we were onto the right guy. But Chemack himself, to his coworkers, was a popular guy. Now, he wasn't a Mr. Socialite, but he was very friendly, outgoing, gregarious, very helpful. He was not one of those standard stereotypes that we would look for if someone, a disgruntled employee, is unhappy at work and maybe wants to get back at his employer, or he's greedy and wants to earn money. Now, he loved this. He clearly loved this job, and he volunteered to go to other facilities across the country to troubleshoot. Anybody wanted to ask him a question, had a engineering problem, he would help him. And so when we went to that facility, and eventually when we were able to be open about it and interview other people, they all liked Chi and said, no, it can't be true about him. I'll help you, but I know I'll be showing you that you're wrong. This isn't the guy. He wouldn't do this. So he was popular, well-liked by management and coworkers.
Right. So you said this case, of course, you know, began with a tip, could have easily been dismissed or mishandled, didn't seem like an obvious suspect. What sort of made you and your colleagues take it seriously then? And how did it escalate from, you know, we'll look into this? He doesn't seem like a Robert Hansen type, we'll say, into this full-blown multi-agency task force with real resources behind it.
Well, what made us take it seriously is once we started checking out the lead that these technologies are being stolen, and they were very important technologies. Once we saw that he was, in fact, collecting these in the home, we knew we had the right guy, and this was serious because all the information we were given, we checked out. It all checked out. So basically, to get the coverages in counterintelligence, like I said, you can't go openly to a judge. You have to go to the FISA court, and it's a judge who's been rotated onto the FISA court so they can, they've been cleared so they can see classified information. So once we showed them our initial collection, what the trash was showing, what our surveillance was showing, they started giving us incrementally more intrusive coverages. The first being microphones. The first being telephone taps on their phone lines. And once we got that, we proved a little more this guy's collecting just these technologies that we've been told are going to China. Then we eventually got permission to implant microphones and to covert searches in the house. And that's what we did. And once we got in that house, that blew any doubt out of our mind, because he had piles like 2 foot high of technical documents around his house, by the front door, dining room table, bedroom, their second bedroom, everywhere. That verified for us, okay, we're on the right track. This guy's dangerous. And of course, we had documented that he had just been to China, and that he had multiple trips to Asia, but his methodology was he would never fly directly to China. So our records will always stop at Taipei or Manila or Singapore or South Korea, Seoul. But we did see that one time coming back from China, and basically it's obvious he's going to China each time. And he's cleaning himself by taking a separate flight to China.
So he was a contractor for the U.S. Navy, or he worked for a U.S. Navy contractor.
His company was, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Focused on U.S. submarine technology. I was wondering if you could say a little bit more specifically about that technology and what it sort of would have meant if the Chinese got their hands on it.
Sure. The key technology we first were told about is quiet electric drive, which is a new way to not only quiet but control the acoustic signature of submarines. And that's an area we've always had a big lead over the Soviets, or the Russians now, and the Chinese. And that's submarines' only defense is how quiet it is. So we can track theirs hopefully they can't track cars. And he was going to give that, he was trying to give that information away when we actually arrested him. Others we discovered along the way was electromagnetic weapons and platforms. Specifically, our newest aircraft carriers are going to be using electricity, not steam catapults, to launch and land, and not hooks, to launch and land planes. It means the planes can be lighter, fly farther with more fuel, more armaments, more ammo, weapons. That's another one. Then DDX was our newest destroyer, going to be an all-electronic ship. And that's the information he was also giving away, along with survivability studies on how to survive a battle for a battleship. And then Aegis radar, which was, we were decades ahead of everyone else on that. And I didn't realize till the trial how important that technology was and what a lead and advantage it gave our U.S. Navy. So all that stuff going to China means if we ever get in a conflict, that's American soldiers in the water, dead. And like it should, most people, that enraged me. We had to get this guy. We had
to stop him. Yeah, absolutely. And so Chinese intelligence collection, we'll get more into this a bit later because it's very sort of non-traditional in the sense that our community is structured. But I guess their intelligence operations look at acquiring this sort of technology, A, to figure out how to defeat it against us, but also how to gather it for themselves to increase the survivability and effectiveness of their own platforms, too. They're doing both at the same time.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And mm-hmm. they're trying to surpass us. At least they want to be able to make the Seventh Fleet step down if they ever do decide to retake Taiwan or assert themselves more aggressively in the South China Sea.
Right. So Mac looked like the definition of a low-key model immigrant engineer. He had this access for years, as you said. In hindsight, do you think there were warning signs? And why do you think someone like that could have operated for so long without tripping alarms?
Well, one of the ways he did that is he tried to steal items that were still being researched and hadn't yet been classified. When they're attached to a platform, they're classified. But if you classified all the research done for any of our military branches, it would just bankrupt us. They've got to keep that at a lower level of a classification. So he would steal things that weren't quite classified yet, but had promise that were developing. And QED was one of those things. There were some classified items he stole. But for all those years, he tended to steal things that weren't classified and therefore didn't have as much scrutiny under them. He also was very careful. He and his wife, Rebecca, they didn't mix with anybody. There wasn't a socializing outside of a few other people who are also intelligence agents or officers. And so there wasn't a lot of opportunity to see him that way. Now, at work, there were a couple of suspicious signs. Again, he was very friendly and helpful. That wasn't it. But once in a while, he would go to the IT officer at the company and say, "Hey, I've got this information. I want to share it with somebody." He didn't say China. He was implying other engineers there at work. He said, "I need to share it with them, so can you put it on a disk for me? Or can you put it, they had a limit to the size of their emails that could be sent out. So I can't send it to them that way. Can you put it on a disk and I'll send that to them?" And so this IT officer, trusting Chi, who had a clearance himself, did that. It felt really bad later when he learned that she was actually doing that so he could take it home, copy it, and then send an encrypted disk of that same information to China. So he was never reckless. Probably the most reckless thing he did, which I don't call it as much, but it was throw away a tasking list in the trash. Tore it into tiny pieces, smaller than a dime. And it was out of anger from his tasking. He didn't like... They were tasking him what was obvious, and he already knew what was needed. So he just tore it up and threw away. After 2 years, nearly 2 years of going through the trash and finding very mundane, everyday items, our agents, thankfully, were still conscientious enough to do a good job on a tough task, stinky task, and found these tiny bits of paper. We put it all back together, and that was probably the most foolish thing he did. That's the only thing that revealed himself to the outside world. And that's only if we were already onto him and looking through his trash.
Let's take a break and we'll be right back.
Mm-hmm.
Dakota has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit RightRug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
Extra Value Meals are back. For just $5, get a savory and sweet sausage, egg, and cheese McGriddles, plus hash browns and a coffee. Only at McDonald's.
For limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. Prices may be higher in Hawaii, Alaska, and California, and for delivery.
This is an ad by BetterHelp. Workplace stress is now a leading cause of declining mental health, with 61% of the global workforce feeling it more than ever. You can't escape work, but you can take small steps to care for yourself. A walk, some sun, a favorite song. Therapy is one of those steps. Ongoing support to build resilience for whatever your day throws at you. Balance is tough. Getting help shouldn't be. Visit BetterHelp.com today for 10% off your first month.
So once you were into the investigation, you know, this, of course, became a long, resource-intensive operation. You know, wiretaps, you mentioned the trash pull is really glamorous work that you surely were not paid enough for. These covert entries into his house, cameras, the works. Can you walk us through, I guess, to the extent that you can, the tradecraft and the operational tempo, what that looks like and how you kept something that intrusive, both legal, so it's permissible in a court as evidence, and invisible across, you know, the multiple agencies that were involved. And I think you partnered with NCIS quite a bit on this, of course.
Yes. We brought them in right away because of all the Navy assets involved. So as far as the investigation itself, I know some people will hear about this case and say, well, how outrageous that was. You covertly searched their house and planted microphones and cameras in there. And I want to emphasize, this is not a regular thing. I've been a counterintelligence agent for over 20 years, and I'd never done a covert entry. Nothing like that. This was the first and last case where we did that because we had so much evidence about the drastic harm that was being done. But so as far as work up to it, like I said, there was stages. First, we're putting GPS trackers in the cars and tapping telephones. Then we put microphones in the cars. Then we were able to go into the house to plant microphones and do a covert search. And to do that, we basically have some experts back at Quantico, Virginia. Most of them former agents that were hired back because they were very good at this. And they travel around the country for different cases, terrorism, and counterintelligence, help us do covert entries like this. So we had to, beforehand, my squad and support people were fantastic. They put together this whole profile of the whole neighborhood. It's not like the movies. We don't dress like black ninjas in black and sneak in and sneak out. That's too dangerous of getting seen. And if there's witnesses, we don't kill people. So our case is blown. Right. So we have to be really careful. So we'd see who the smokers were. There was a guy across the street who would come out like 3 a.m. smoke on the porch. People next door, their bathroom faced the house. We'd time basically when they tended to get up and use it at 2 a.m, that sort of thing. We knew we'd have to be out of there by 5 because it was a blue collar neighborhood, lots of contractors getting up to go to work. And we generally couldn't go before midnight. Usually it was closer to 2 o'clock. So we had a very small window to get into that house. And to do that, we needed to, as I said, we had to figure out the rhythms of the neighborhood. So we figured out, we saw and noticed that she and Rebecca would always park their car on the curb in front of their house at night. Well, because they were such solitary people and didn't really talk to their neighbors, the neighbors didn't know when they weren't at home. And there was there were three trips they took, one on Alaskan cruise, one to Europe, one to Hawaii, where we were able to use that week to get into the house. And to do that, we actually bought a car, a 1998 Plymouth Voyager. It was the same as theirs, beat up the same color. And when they drove theirs to LAX and parked it for their flight, we would use that vehicle, our vehicle, to drive to the front curb. We pulled out the back seats, jammed all the agents, up to six agents in the back, all in fetal positions, lying on their sides, so no one would see them, park in front of that house. And then our lookouts, our surveillance, and people watching poll cameras that we had up on the house to see what neighbor activities were. We'd get the all clear signal, and then we'd slide that door open, quickly walk across the lawn and walk into the house in single file, hoping to expose yourself as little as possible. Once inside, you can't open windows. This is the summer, the first entry in Southern California. The house is very small, 700 square feet. They never improved anything in there, and hot, and we're all sweaty and can't turn on the air conditioning, can't turn the lights, obviously. Basically we have these small flashlights with red covers on them to make it less visible. And basically I got to keep those lights below the windows and any windows and doors, and very slowly walk around the house. You can't disturb anything that's going to be left that way because you don't want them to know you were there. One of the hardest things we had is they were horrible housekeepers, layers of dust covering everything. So if you disturbed anything, you're leaving a trail. So we had to proceed very carefully.
And their upbringing, and you mentioned the way how modest the house was, how small it is, despite, I mean, being working for a contractor with these big, you know, Navy contracts. You made pretty good money, especially for the time, but yet, you know, lived so modestly. And he and his wife had sort of an interesting upbringing in China that sort of ingrained in them that to live this way far below their means. I was wondering if you could say a little bit more about that. I found that pretty interesting.
Yes. Well, once we had microphones in the house, we could hear their conversations, and they spoke very lovingly of Mao Zedong and Joseph Stalin, talking about how these poor guys were misunderstood and they did so much good for the world. And part of that, I mentioned that because these were hardcore Maoists and they'd grown up under the worst times in China. They survived very well because of their intelligence connections through the Cultural Revolution, the Great Leap Forward, when millions starved, they were well fed. So they had no empathy or understanding of what communism really does. But they also, being from that background, they were extremely frugal, just unbelievably frugal. I've never seen anybody live this way. And one of the benefits of living that way is you're able to save a lot of money. So by the time we arrested him, he had $1 million in the bank, which he lost a lot of it to attorney's fees, which made me very happy. Because they wanted a free government lawyer, and we fought that. We made them buy their own attorneys and spend a lot of money. We also actually seized some of that money under a unique theory of they defrauded the government and their company all these years being agents. So we seized a couple $100,000 that way. But I'm getting off track there. So they did a lot of things that were really strange behavior that initially we thought was operational. It's got something to do with intelligence behavior. But it turned out most of that, almost all of it, was because they were so cheap. They would switch hotel rooms from one hotel to another in Vegas when he was there for work because they would save $1 to $2 a night at the other hotel. Every Saturday, they would go to a gas station and fill up for the week. And they wouldn't just gas up, and they wouldn't just clean the windshields. They would clean the whole car with what the station provided. We thought they were looking for surveillance. You're walking 360 around your car. You can look everywhere. No, it's because they didn't want to expend hose, soap, water money at home. And we saw that evidence in home as well. And then they would go on from that gas station to a hardware store, which had one entrance, and they'd go in and go to the lumber section. They'd stay there for 15, 20 minutes, and then they would leave. They'd never buy anything every week. We thought, okay, they're going back to the lumber section, they're probably looking back at the entrance to see if they see the same faces each week coming and going. Or they're servicing a dead drop back there. They're picking up information or messages or leaving them. Now, once we sent a team in there, there was free coffee being served every Saturday at that location. They would grab that coffee and they'd go in the back and drink it and throw it away in the lumber. Maybe they didn't want the employees seeing that they were never buying anything, just drinking their coffee, and they left. That's the sort of behavior we got used to. So after a while, when we had some other agencies helping us, and they'd say, hey, that's operational behavior. We'd say, no, these people are just cheap. And we'd explain to them, and after a while, they got on board with, okay, we don't have to worry about that behavior. So that really threw us in the beginning.
Right. So I guess, you know, as you're spending months, years, potentially watching a suspect, a subject, digging through their trash, listening to phone calls, maybe you get a warrant to go inside their house. You know, you're observing a lot of really suspicious behavior. As you said, you know, Occam's razor is pretty obvious. They're real operational indicators of what's going on here, but yet you haven't quite hit legally that bar where you or other agents on the task force can, you know, break out the handcuffs and bring these guys in and put them in front of a judge. Where is that sort of bar? Like, what are you, when you're running an investigation like this, what are you looking to observe to the point where you can say, okay, let's take them in and let's end this?
Well, it's a great question because early on that first year, as I said, we found stacks of documents. Now, it was against regulations for him to have it there. He wasn't storing it properly. But if we arrest him for that, he'll get a slap on the wrist. He probably won't do any time at all. He'll just go back to what he's doing. We'll look discredited, you know, like we claimed more than was there. So the first big notch we needed was we have to show that he's operating on behalf of China. He's following their directions. And that's where the trash I earlier mentioned came in big. Because once we put together two lists that he had torn and thrown away, we found one was a list, 1 through 9, listing technologies they wanted in China. And the last one was DDX, the destroyer information. And we found another list where he is actually being told, hey, we want you to go to conferences. We want you to gather that information, that sensitive information on disks, and then send it to us, and we'll use it for research purposes. And below that was another list of a bunch of electromagnetic technologies they wanted. So that was the first big. Now we had intent and direction and following tasking. But we had to show not only was he collecting it, but that he delivered it. So we kept watching him. By this time, we had cameras in his house, one over his dining room table and one over his computer desk in their second bedroom. And we were watching 24/7. And early Sunday morning, I get a call at home from one of our watchers, we call them lookouts, saying, hey, we've got him copying disks onto his laptop and then making more disks. Now, they're speaking Chinese, so the lookout doesn't know what they're saying yet, and our linguists aren't there at that moment. But he says, this is the behavior that we saw him being tasked to do in the tasking list. So I call emergency meeting for the following morning, early morning. We get together. I tell the linguists, who are to no fault of their own, it's really our Los Angeles and FBI headquarters then provided us enough linguists. They're about 2 weeks behind. I tell them, okay, start yesterday, start Sunday, and work forward and backward. We got to know why they're doing this. And later that afternoon, they gave me summaries, and sure enough, she and Rebecca are copying together. They're both fully involved in doing this. And they're saying, okay, here's the stuff we're sending to Pu Pei Liang. Turns out to be their handler in China. He won't understand. He's a computer guy, but when I retire in a couple months and go back, we'll explain everything. Mm. And they talked about it, that they're going to give it to Tai, who's going to encrypt it. And because of that, and they're going to hide it on the disk, that if customs stops them, they won't find anything. And, you know, Tai's got his duties. We've got our duties. And so then the hairs on my neck stood up. Okay, now they're attempting to transmit it. Those are all the elements we need to bring this to court. And I had assurances from my headquarters managers that if we find all those elements, they'll work to declassify all of our coverages so that we can use this in court, which normally is not the case. That's why counterintelligence cases don't normally go to trial, because normally if you have to declassify your source, you're revealing a capability you don't want to reveal. But the fact that we can plant microphones and cameras houses, they do that for mafia and other organized crime. So that's not something that has to remain classified. So that's what you need. You got to show each step because, and for instance, all the information was encrypted. And it was encrypted with a program that was nearly unbreakable. We were told it might take years and years to break that code. So if we hadn't recovered the encryption disks and the encryption laptop from Timex house, we wouldn't have been able to break that. And then we couldn't have proven what was on the disk. All we could say is, yeah, they mentioned QED and they mentioned this conference, but we can't identify which one it is or what the specific information is. So we wouldn't have a charge. So even at that point, we didn't have a case until we decrypted that and could prove he was sending sensitive information per Chinese tasking.
I want to illustrate the sort of chain of command here for folks. At the time, you were supervising a CI squad and the Orange County resident agency, was it?
Well, I wasn't actually a supervisor yet. I was the case agent, which was actually a bigger job because there were hundreds under me. My supervisor was Sal Valdez, and I mentioned him only because he was fantastic. I've had so many bad supervisors that as soon as we get pushback from anybody above them, they throw the agent under the bus. And we had to fight, and this is my book, we had to fight constant battles every day. And Sal was always there to back us up. But I was a case agent.
Yeah. Right. So yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that. So okay, so above you guys working this in Orange County, right, is the Los Angeles field office. Third largest field office in the country with its own counterintelligence division. Of course, above that is headquarters with the big counterintelligence division. You know, there's a lot of specialized resources that come to bear in a case like this. You know, the special surveillance groups on the ground, aviation assets, technical folks back at Quantico. You mentioned the linguists that you get on this case. And, you know, the Bureau, of course, has greater resources than any other law enforcement agency in the country, but it's still not unlimited. And of course, you know, GMAC at the time was not the only serious counterintelligence investigation in the country, probably not the only serious one, even in Southern California, given the given the size of the defense industrial base in the area. I was wondering if you could speak a little bit to that friction of having to keep all these resources on this one case for such an extended period of time versus, you know, people up the chain of command trying to pull this away, thinking it would be better served for this other case that probably is showing better leads at the time. That's pretty difficult. Right.
Yeah. And to be fair to them in the beginning, ours was one of many cases, as you imply, around the Bureau that were being worked. But eventually it did become the number one Chinese espionage case in the country for the Bureau. And yet we still had those resources issues. Initially, it was pushback all from the Los Angeles field office, which usually is the most supportive when I've had past cases that use resources. But there had been a collapsed case a year before, the Katrina Leung J.J. Smith case. And it had left such a bad taste in the Bureau's mouth because it collapsed because of the United States Attorney's Office in Los Angeles, that they really didn't want to put in so many resources like they had with the previous case. So they fought it tooth and nail. And so every linguist we tried to get and every lookout, for instance, they'd say, well, we've got other important cases and we need these lookouts to watch these cameras. And I'd say, are those people identified known intelligence officers? And they'd say, well, no, we're working to see if they are. I said, we have one. And he has already sent information to China. And he's going to do it again. We are top priority. That didn't win me the argument in and of itself. I had to have backing again from Sal. But then normally headquarters is the problem. Well, we had direct supervisors, first Randy Coleman, then Sandy Cable, who were fantastic. And they fought tooth and nail to get and keep us those resources. Another time the head of the linguist unit in headquarters, a very imperious woman, tried to pull our linguists and say, we'll just farm your work out around the country. And she said, they're all cogs. They're all equal. You know, every linguist is the same as the other. Not true.
Yeah.
First, they tried to give us some guys who were so old, they couldn't hear. They had the headphones on. They couldn't hear. the microphones weren't the best, to be fair to them, but they couldn't hear what was being said. We needed young ears who could hear that because we were already boosting the signal and such. And so she came out and I told the linguists, and there was a culture that was encouraged, like all the Farsi translators are here, and Mandarin and Shanghainese and Russian, and they were kind of allowed to run themselves. And so it ended up being all these old world groups and bringing the cultural restraints with them. So for instance, in the Chinese speakers, all the good jobs, the ones that were higher profile, were given to the older ones, whether or not, not on merit, but on age. And if the younger ones said anything, they were ridiculed by the older ones. We had to change that. So we actually pulled our linguists out of those special groups that were at an offsite and brought them on site next to the agents. And that was revolutionary. Because now we weren't just a disembodied voice on the phone. We were the agents there talking to them, exchanging ideas with them, asking them for cultural references, what they meant. And it was invaluable. And they became full-blooded, enthusiastic team members. We had 3 to 4 linguists that we stuck with and who ended up testifying. But we had to fight tooth and nail to keep them throughout the case. Same with the lookouts, as I said. Same with surveillance, although the surveillance people were better about that. So, yes, every morning, Sal and I and my co-case at Sheldon Fong, Gunnar Newquist, we would meet, say, okay, what challenges are we having now? Who do we have to talk to? How do we handle it? And we actually developed strategies to do that. Gunnar, who was our NCIS agent, sometimes he would go to NCIS and say, you know, that the FBI is ponying up all these resources. We haven't really done anything other than offer me and a couple other things. You know, we really got to hold up our end. Then other times I'd go to the headquarters and say, look, NCIS is small compared to us, and yet look what all the things they're doing. We can at least do this. And I would go to LA with the same issues. And by hook or crook, we certainly didn't get everything we wanted, but we got enough to keep the case going. And those tasking lists from the trash kind of silenced a lot of the naysayers who had said, this isn't going anywhere. You're never going to get anywhere with this.
Yeah. And just to sort of, I guess, touch again on the importance of the linguists there, you know.
Yes.
Mandarin is so difficult for people who don't speak it well, you know, the sort of nuance of it, the way it's pronounced can sort of totally change the difference of what's meant by a word or something. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and for, I guess, Johnny America G-Men, you know, that's just sort of so impenetrable. I know someone who's sort of familiar with this field a bit, and he once described to me Mandarin as China's first line of encryption. You know, what they discuss internally amongst themselves is very different from what they discuss when it's being broadcast outward to an English speaking audience. I guess speaks to the importance of having really good linguists who sort of understand how the language works and that sort of cultural nuance behind it.
Yeah, if I can add in, it's a great point too. And a lot of people don't understand how difficult that part of it was. Mm-hmm. It's a tonal language. And if your microphones aren't picking up well, then it's tough to, you know, a rising tone or setting tone, a different word, same pronunciation, different word. So that's tough. But then they were using 3 different dialects, and it's not dialect like we think of, like a Southern accent or Northeastern accent. The printed language is the same, but we also had Shanghainese and Cantonese, which were spoken often. And sometimes in the middle of a sentence, they'd switch dialects. And the word is pronounced completely differently. So a Mandarin speaker, unless he's been to the Shanghai area, doesn't understand Shanghainese when they're speaking. Not just a heavy accent, it's different pronunciation. So we had to have linguists who can understand all of them or one of them well, and then another one, a different dialect well. And Shanghainese was especially hard to find linguists for because it's not as common as Mandarin or Cantonese. So that multiplied the issue. And these people we used were fantastic. They made the case.
Yeah, yeah. Without giving away every beat of the book, of course, because folks still need to read it after they hear this, is there a particular moment in the operation, you know, where you felt, if we blow this, this whole thing collapses? You know, years of digging through this dude's trash is just a waste of time.
Yes. Yeah, there was. It's a great question. I don't know. I've never been asked that. I didn't address that specifically in the book that way. But the moment came when it was when we saw what they and heard what they were doing and copying this, and we knew we were going to have to make an arrest. Mm-hmm. That's when I was surprised. I would have thought that's when I would be the most satisfied. We've got everything. But that's when I was the most worried, because we were being told we had to make the arrest immediately. And most people out listening to you would say, well, yeah, of course you did. Well, no, we didn't, but we were made to do it anyway. And when you rush an operation like this from zero to 60 in just a couple, few days, all sorts of mistakes, legal ones or otherwise, can be made that can weaken or destroy the case. And so we had a plan. What I haven't mentioned is, we've mentioned Chimak, his wife Rebecca, his brother Ty, his wife Fook Lee, and his son Billy were also involved. Billy did the encryption. Fook Lee was part of his cover. She would travel with him when Ty was carrying Chi's information back to China. Well, Fook Lee was also engaged in her own marriage fraud business here. She would hook up rich Chinese with poor Americans who were willing to be paid to marry the so-called Mary, the person, so they could get here. And then, of course, they divorced, and then that person would stay. Well, she was heavily involved in that, and we heard this on the phones, and she was worried that she was going to get arrested because her colleagues in Alhambra and Monterey Park area were doing the same thing, were getting arrested. So we thought, okay, we're going to arrest her and Ty at the airport with a diss, and we'll take everything, and we'll search the home under the marriage fraud violation. They won't know, she won't know that we know about the spying activity. And so we'll collect all that. We'll have time to make a bigger, better case, take our time. And the problem was, the Tuesday after this revelation of what was happening at the home with the copying of the disc, passing the tie, was that we brought in NCIS, FBI, and the Navy. And Navy assets are what we're going to be charging him with stealing eventually. And they mm-hmm. said, no, you have to arrest him immediately. We can't take a chance of QED leaving the United States. And I said, there is no chance. We're going to arrest him. We're going to seize everything. And then, you know, maybe we'll screw up the disc and give it back to him that's unusable. And they'll just, because Billy had made some writing errors when he made the disc. So we're good. And they said, no, you have to arrest. And I didn't understand why my FBI supervisors weren't sticking up for us. And we lost that battle. They wouldn't give us a vote. So the higher ups voted and said, oh, you have to arrest him on Friday, days away. And I asked later, why not the support? And he said, look, these guys said, if we don't do what they want, they're not providing the experts. They're not providing the people to testify about the sensitivity of technologies. They're not cooperating. So either we do that or we lose this ability to try him for this stuff. And I thought that was crazy. Not him, but their reasoning. But that's why I was furious, but that's why we ended up being rushed, which means we have to use a lot of people for all the searches who don't know about the case. We're going to be interviewing five people, four of whom do not speak English. Uh-huh. Chimak was the only one who we could interview in English. So we're going to have to get agents who speak it, who don't know the case, because we don't have that many we only have a couple on our squad who speak Mandarin. And so they're not going to know the right questions to ask. We're going to be rushed and everything. And it almost happened, not only because of that, but again, I understand these past cases that failed because the United States attorneys. They and the Department of Justice on Friday, when I was supposed to go on Friday morning and sign the warrant, Friday night, we're going to make the arrest. They argued for over 7 hours that day about what charges to bring. We told them, easy. We got acting as a foreign agent. All you have to show is tasking and that he's fulfilling that tasking. You don't have to show the sensitivity, the technology. You don't have to show any of that. But they always, most of these attorneys think they're smarter than agents. So they said, no, we got to do this. They picked a charge that was legally indefensible, and they told us this at 4 o'clock. They said, okay, here's the charge you're going to use. Well, by that time, we have no time. We're going to arrest them before they fly to China. So there was actually a concern we're not going to get to them in time because of the dithering of these high-level executive level attorneys. We barely got there in time. We were able to make the arrest, but our whole timetable was set way back by these attorneys arguing all day about the right charge, and then they come up with the wrong one. And the way I can I can with confidence say it was the wrong one. It's because immediately they withdrew it and they brought the charge that we had wanted them to do all along. And it got us in trouble with the press and the judge because they all thought, oh, that means it's a weak case or changing charges. No, it was stupid attorneys who picked the wrong charge. Mm-hmm. I'm not an attorney. I went to law school, finished. I could see, and you could see if you looked at it, the statute that it did not cover the information that she had stolen, yet that's what they went with.
You
so there were a couple times during that week when I thought, man, we're in trouble.
Yeah. You mentioned U.S. attorney's offices a couple times, sort of blowing CI investigations. Is that a common point of failure, them picking the wrong charges?
Not so much. Well, yes, I should say yes, picking the wrong charges. But the biggest weakness, when I say picking the wrong charges, they're not picking the right charges. They're, for instance, before this case, I had tried to bring charges before against people in the Vietnamese community who were working for Vietnam and were threatening and trying to influence the community and U.S. policy. And I'd say, let's bring this acting as agent of the foreign government. I can show the tasking. I can show what they're doing. I'd say, oh, no, that's a BS charge. Nobody brings that charge anymore. That's only got 5 years a maximum for prison. I'd say, I'll take it. We just need to highlight them in the community as being agents of a foreign government. I said, no. And I said, well, how about when they make misstatements to us? You know, 1001 charge of lying to an agent. No. You know, we need something more certain. So all these people were not charged because most of what they were doing wasn't at the level of stealing classified. Mm-hmm. So that's one thing. And so they didn't want to do CHMAC, and that's originally why they didn't do it that way. But since the CHMAC case, all the cases since, they're charging it now because it works. It's an easy charge to bring, and it's an easy charge to prove. And we did it with all the five defendants in Mac and with Greg Chung, the associate we tried later, and we saw it later after that. So the CHMAC case and the Greg Chung cases opened the doors, showed prosecutors. Now, I don't mean the lowest level ones. I'm talking about the executives that run them, that these are charges worth bringing. We have to put people in jail if we're going to deter this behavior. We can't just let them do 6 months or go on probation. It doesn't teach them anything.
Yeah. So take us back into that night of the arrest at LAX. What exactly was at stake in those hours, and how close did you feel you were to watching, you know, critical naval secrets literally fly out of the country?
Well, in one way, we were very close. We weren't going to let that happen, so we were going to arrest even if it had to be on our own initiative. But those kind of charges wouldn't stick. We'd be embarrassed. The case would fall apart. Mm-hmm. But we'd do it because we weren't going to let that information go. But we all also wanted to get a conviction. So I was so far behind by this arguing by attorneys that the judges had all gone home. What would have been a 5-minute drive to Santa Ana that morning to swear before the judge, I had to go up to the northern San Fernando Valley on a Friday rush hour, which is a 3-hour drive.
Yeah.
I was cursing them as I was driving. I was driving on the shoulder, driving in the median. People were honking at me mad, but I had to get there. I was actually hoping Highway Patrol would pull me over. I'd tell them the problem and they'd escort me. But as I said in the book, there's never a cop when you need one. In this instance, I wanted to get pulled over because, you know, I've got lights, but I'm in a undercover car and it just wouldn't sell if I put those on. So I get up to judges and the whole drive up, I'm getting calls because we're watching Billy, the son, drive his parents to LAX, and we have I haven't even gotten before the judge yet. And I race up there. I'm all sweaty, disheveled. I go to his house. His wife is very nice, brings me in. He comes in. He starts reading. But it's a long warrant, long affidavit. As he's reading, I'm taking calls on my radio, my cell phone, panicked people saying he's getting off at Century Boulevard. He's almost at LAX. Do we have signed orders? And no, we don't. But fortunately, the judge hears it, and he's finished reading. And he has to sign many duplicates of these orders for the various locations we're going to search and people we're going to arrest. And he says, sounds like you have a problem there. I said, yeah, they're supposed to be on a midnight flight to China, and we're a couple hours away, and they're about to go to the airline counter, go through security where we need to arrest them then. And he said, okay. And he signs the first one. He says, you tell them, as far as they're concerned, all the orders are signed. And I put it out, and you can hear a sigh of relief go across Southern California. So now that agents are cut loose. So we're waiting to arrest Chi and Rebecca at their house once we've made the arrest at LAX. We're going to arrest everyone right away so nobody can destroy any evidence. Sheldon Fung is running my co-case, and he's running the arrest at LAX. And he tells us, the agents there, okay, we're going to divide them up right away. So I want half of you on this side, half on this side. When they walk through, you come in and you take them apart. I don't want them to say a word. You take everything out of their hands. They can't push any buttons or send any calls, any emergency warnings, anything. And he and they did a great job. If you've seen the video, which I put up on for the website of the book, it's a masterful job. They just separate them. Nobody seems to see anything. Now, even the other passengers coming off don't seem to notice what's going on, except one guy. One guy who we had because we treated our surveillance people so well, they were, again, part of the team like the linguists. The guys who had been watching them in the morning were off, but they really wanted to see this ending, and they wanted to do a double shift. So we said, okay, we got our other people. We got the main, your colleagues watching the main subjects when they get arrested. We want you to do a perimeter and see if they see anything else amiss. And they see this Asian male standing on the sidewalk at LAX outside videotaping Fook, who's in a bright yellow jacket near the airline counter. And every time Ty, her husband, who's in a line, turns towards him, that guy turns his camera away and then he turns it back again. And so they report this. They say, okay, you stay on him. And once we've done the arrest, we'll come and see about this other guy. Well, it turns out this guy, Mr. Luo, is a counterintelligence agent, counter-surveillance agent, I should say, for China. And he is videotaping them. Now, he didn't admit to this, but we know what he was doing. He was videotaping them looking for either signs that they've been compromised by us, meaning our surveillance guys. Fortunately, our guys are better, and we saw him first, so he didn't see us. Or he's watching them to see if they're working for us, if we've doubled them back. You know, if I foolishly, and some people might be tempted to do this, said, hey, you're doing us a favor, so let's take you around security. He would have seen that, and he would have reported that. And then they probably never would have come back from China if that had been the case. But instead, he films them, and then gets right in line behind them through security. They actually look at each other and show no sign of recognition. If you and I were in line, I'd say, hey, I'd talk to you or something. They just look at each other and look away. Well, in fact, they knew each other. She had gotten him into the country through her marriage fraud scheme. He had a wife and kids in China, but she married him up with someone in the United States so he could try for a green card later. So we waited. We made the arrest of them, started interviewing them. And then another agent, Dennis Kim, great guy. He kind of was supervising all this. He went over there, found out Mr. Luo was now in the bathroom, and he went and confronted him in the bathroom. We seized all the stuff off of him, found the film, found he'd done other counter surveillance filming at MIT, Harvard, and University of Minnesota when Chinese delegations were visiting. And he didn't admit, obviously, to a lot, but he gave us a few tidbits showing us that he, in fact, had a link with the guy I've mentioned as the handler, Pu Pei Liang, at Zhongzheng University in Guangzhou. So we wanted to charge him. And again, the executives of the United States Attorney's Office said, no, we don't have enough. They're worried they might lose, which always seems to be their overwhelming fear. And so we had to cut him loose. We didn't give him his stuff back. He got on the same flight. He was supposed to be on the flight with them. He got on that flight and went back to China, never came back. Tried to get his stuff back to an attorney. And we said, you can have it now, but you've got to come back to the United States to sign for it. Of course, he never came. So that was a little frosting on the cake that we didn't see coming. But right after that arrest at LAX, we arrested Chi and Rebecca, and we drove them out to Los Angeles field office for questioning. All five of these people did not invoke their right to an attorney or to silence. They were willing to talk to us. All of them lied, which is fine. I'd rather them talk to us and lie than not talk to us. And it still provides a lot of information, the lies do.
So, you know, this case, of course, has been described as a landmark in how the FBI handles Chinese espionage and, you know, how CI investigations are prosecuted more broadly. You spoke a bit about that earlier. There's a somewhat of a debate right now on which arm of the U.S. government should coordinate and be sort of responsible for counterintelligence investigations sort of more broadly, whether it should stay with the Bureau or whether the DNI, the Director of National Intelligence's offices, should be more responsible for that, like should doing this inside the intelligence community more proper. Just wondering from, you know, a professional's perspective, how do you feel about that? Where do you come down on it?
Well, people will say I'm biased since I'm a former FBI agent, but right. It definitely needs to stay with us. Absolutely. I have no problem with NCIS or some of the other military intelligence agencies working with us. Absolutely, we need them. But we're the only ones that make that jump that hump between classified and criminal. And we know how to try a criminal case. We do. I'm not saying the United States Attorney's Office does, but no matter who it is that's investigating, they're going to have to deal with that same office. To me, that office is the problem. That Department of Justice and the way they run things as far as counter-espionage investigations, that's the problem. But FBI should definitely keep it. That 5 days that we had to go from 0 to 60, that CIA couldn't have done that. NSA certainly couldn't have done that. NCIS, maybe. But again, we work better as partners. So to me, you're asking for disaster if you assign this to one of these other agencies.
Is that just a matter of resources? You know, the sort of nationwide and international reach that the Bureau has as compared to some of these more specialized agencies?
Well, yeah, you could certainly make that argument as well. If I had time, I could give you a lot more arguments, but you make a good one because we have our 52 main field offices. And then like where I work, Santa Ana, that's a resident agency, which is basically a satellite office in Los mm-hmm. Angeles. So we have coverage over the entire United States and its territories. We have people in Guam. Puerto Rico, obviously, you've got a field office there. But the point is, your point, this is well taken, is that we have the coverage and we have the relationships with local police departments. For instance, when we did a covert entry, right. We went to Downey PD's chief of police. We said, and he was great about it. We said, we've got this house. We don't want to tell you which one because it's still classified, but we have this house. We need to look. We need to go through their trash. We're actually going to do covert entries. And he said, okay, I'll tell you what, I'll give you a squad car. You don't have to tell me the house, just give me the neighborhood. And then your agent can ride with you. And if any problems result that night from your covert entry, a neighbor sees something and reports it and we're supposed to check it out, then you can do it. Your agent in our car, like a ride along, and it worked perfectly. And that's just a small example of the kind of things you're not going to get if you move this to, especially an agency that sees itself as purely intelligence. That will be a disaster. They don't know the rules of evidence. They don't know how to handle evidence. They don't know how to make that transition.
Let's take a break and we'll be right back.
COTA has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com, RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
COTA has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit RightRug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
Hey, everyone. Before we jump into the rest of my conversation with Jim, just wanted to remind folks that at our next Espresso Martini episode, Chris and I will be taking listener questions. So we would love to hear from you guys. Any questions you may have for us on secrets, spies, any of the sort of topics we cover on the show. There's a lot of crazy stuff in the news to talk about, too. So if you want to ask about that or anything you'd like to know about us, if you're so inclined, we would love to hear from you. You can reach out to us via email at secretsandspiespodcast@gmail.com or give us a shout on our social media profiles. All of those links will be in the show notes down below on this episode. If you're going to send us a question, trying to get that in by no later than December 4th, that's when we're supposed to record our next episode together. Yeah, again, we would love to hear from you. Thanks. So I wanted to zoom out now and shift from this one operation to the bigger picture of the threat and sort of what it portends for the near future, potentially. If you draw a line from MAC to what you see today, how has China's approach to espionage evolved, both in scale, sophistication, and the kinds of targets that they care about? And how would you explain their whole of society approach to intelligence that a Western audience would find, you know, pretty alien, just that whole concept?
Well, as far as evolved, they're still doing exactly what they did with CMAQ, and that is sending, first of all, they've always been sending students, academics, businessmen, all that. And of course, they want companies to come to China and then sign contracts where they're going to get access to the technology they want. Once they do, that company's done. You know, so some of the U.S. companies are being very foolish for short-term gain. They're blowing their long-term profits or viability. But there are still there's hundreds and hundreds, thousands of large U.S. companies that are on cutting edge, not only with military technologies, but medical technologies. And years after this, our squad handled something very similar. Midnight arrest, arresting a guy who had made a contract with the Chinese government. He was a naturalized U.S. citizen, ethnic Chinese. He wasn't ideological like CMAQ. He just wanted money. He was an American otherwise, through and through. But he was selling secrets from these different employers to China. And in exchange, they let him start a business over in China so that he could use all this research and development he'd stolen to develop his own, in this case, heart catheters, and undercut the company he worked for in the United States. But it has, when you say evolved, it's expanded. Now I think the greater danger is the cyber warfare. Yeah. They're attacking our infrastructure constantly. And they keep saying they're friends, but friends don't do this. They're constantly undermining, poking, prodding, trying to get into various systems and have succeeded U.S. government system, private company systems to steal technology, steal information about employees. And that will come in handy later. Those employees travel to China. They can use that information against them. Maybe they need money. Maybe they've got a bad marriage and they're going to do a honeypot or something. The point is they're constantly stealing from the United States in a very aggressive, hostile manner, with the total goal of supplanting the United States. But it's just become broader. I'm not a policymaker, but we don't need tens of thousands of Chinese students in our technology areas and at universities working on research, cutting edge research that they're going to send back to China. They're actually obligated to do that. They're told when they leave China that when you come back, we're going to have some questions for you. We expect you to give us the answers. So that it's a problem we're not really addressing. as broadly as we should.
Yeah. And, you know, since leaving the Bureau, of course, you've briefed contractors, academic institutions sort of on this threat exactly. Where do you see sort of our biggest blind spots? Is it on campuses, Western companies partnering with Chinese firms, or is it sort of more the cyber threat of that on our critical infrastructure, you know, that you mentioned a bit earlier?
Well, the cyber threat is huge, and I know we're trying to address it. And I'm not a cyber expert, so that's one area I know what's happening, but I don't know the details of it. I would speak more to, and the business side of it, if we're going to remain a free country, companies generally should be able to do business with who they want, but we need to be warning them more heavily than we are, more emphatically, that you are going to lose not only the technology, but the market share if you do this. I would address the student issue because they are used in research, and companies and the U.S. government uses these research universities in the beginning, or like QED and other things. And if you have Chinese students working that who are going to go back to China and they're going to share everything they learned, then you're letting them in on the beginning. If China copies our latest fighter, that's bad, but that's a fighter that's already been made, and now we're working on the next technology.
Yeah.
But at the college, university level, research level, that's the beginning of the next generation. And to let them be involved in any way in that research is a huge mistake, I think, because you're letting them in on the ground floor. They're not seeing it after the fact. They're seeing it before we've even developed it. And that's what EMALS was all about. They actually, I believe, put the first EMALS on their aircraft carrier before we did ours. Now, I believe ours is better, but the point is they got in on the ground floor because CHMAC gave that to them when it was still just a concept. And yeah. That's what college students will be able to do when they go back to China.
So when someone finishes chasing Qi, what do you hope stays with them about how espionage really works in the United States and about the human side of the people who spend their careers chasing it?
Well, we see it so infrequently in the news that it becomes a point of interest, but I don't think it sinks home what the cost is. And I'd like them to leave with what the cost is if every time one of these spy operations is successful against the United States. What CHMAC gave them means, and I mentioned it before, it means dead Americans. If we ever get in conflict with China, which is likely if they ever try to retake Taiwan,
yeah,
that loss of Aegis and vastly improving the ability of their aircraft carriers, which they had none of at the time of the CHMAC case, now they're building their fourth, yeah, that means dead Americans. And that means their kids. My co-case in Sheldon Fung, his daughter went to Naval Academy, and she is actually working off the coast of Asia as a submarine acoustics officer. She's not on a submarine, but she's working on that area. And she would, on one of the aircraft carriers, she would be one of the victims. There's been estimates that if there was a battle over Taiwan, we could win that, but it would be at huge cost. Maybe a couple of aircraft carriers lost.
Yeah.
And each aircraft carrier has up to 10,000 people on it, small cities. So to me, that's what they need to take away, that this is really serious. And they need to pass that on to the government officials, especially the Department of Justice, who keeps wanting to undercharge these cases. And some people object that, well, CHMAC only got 24 and a half years. That wasn't enough. I agree. I had fight tooth and nail to get that. And the reason I wanted it is, number one, I wanted the technology to be old by the time he got out of jail, so he couldn't tell him anything that would be helpful. And number two, he was an old guy. He was in his 60s. I say old, I'm in my 60s, but I wanted him to die in jail, and that's exactly what happened. He died in jail, and Greg Chung, the other main spy, I call him main because they're the two that had access to the secrets, they both died in jail, and that's the message that needs to be sent to anybody who's going to do this. You're not going to spend your golden years with your grandchildren. You're going to be in jail, and you're going to die there. So because of how serious what they're doing is, that's the message I want to get. This is serious. It's going to mean American lives. So yeah, Let's start treating it like that and charging and convicting and sentencing people accordingly.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Anything else you'd like to cover today that we haven't so far that I might have missed?
No, it's not that you missed it. There was a very important spinoff case, Greg Chung, because he was friends with Chi Mack. That's how we came onto him. And he was giving away aerospace secrets and space secrets. He actually helped the Chinese avoid investing billions of dollars in a space shuttle program, because they figured out through him the United States was going back to capsules, cheaper, safer. And he gave them all sorts of fighter technology and gave them enough information to help them start their own commercial airline business, which is not a threat to life and limb like the others are, but it severely undercuts Boeing and Boeing's ability to sell airliners around the world. So it's a huge economic loss. And he was convicted of economic espionage. And the reason I bring it up is that was also historic. Chi Mack turned things around. We started charging people with serious crimes and seeking serious sentences. And Kevin Moberly, who was the case agent of that case, sought that. And we got the very first trial conviction of economic espionage. Again, it'd been passed 10 years before the statute, but no prosecutor wanted to touch it because they were afraid it was new law. They might lose the case. And because of the Chi Mack case, we were able to tell them, you've got to do this because this applies perfectly to Greg Chung's case. And because we'd gotten convictions, we'd have the same jury, the same judge, the same agents. After a lot of cajoling, we got them to agree, and they charged them with economic espionage. $2 billion worth of damage done to Boeing, because they also gave away rocket technology. And he went to jail, and he died in jail as well. So two good examples. So yeah. I want to throw that in there because it was one after another, and it really helped kind of set the stage for later prosecutions.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, these are great cases that sort of set up these patterns that we see today. It really comes through in the book. Jim, this has been terrific. Before I let you go, where can listeners find more about your work and what you're doing now and keep up with news about Chasing G?
Well, you mentioned that the book's coming out December 2nd. I think it's available. Well, I know it's available for order now, but it gives all the backstory. As you know, well, no, I've skimmed over a ton of stuff and haven't mentioned a lot of funny stories, dramatic stories, anger-inducing stories. You want to get your blood boiling. So I urge them to read the book, but if they're not sure yet and they want to figure out if they're interested in the book, they can go to chasingchibook.com and they can see a lot of the videos I've talked about, the arrest videos, the other videos, so they can see kind of the results. If they want the background, that's what the book is for. But the website shows them, I think they'll find lots of interesting video and photographs of the evidence we used at both trials. Well, eventually I'm going to add the Greg Chung case to it and I'll be able to see both, but that's where they can go to decide if they're interested.
Yeah, sure. So once more, the book is called Chasing Chi, the FBI's groundbreaking pursuit of China's most prolific spy family. As you said, it's out in the U.S. on December 2nd and the U.K. on the 16th, if I have that right, at least according to Amazon.
I didn't know that, so thanks. I didn't know that, yeah.
That's just what Amazon says. I'm not sure. Okay. But that's what's on there right now. And of course, you know, the book draws from, there's so much more in there than we've had time to cover today. We could have gone on for, you know, hours more, but of course I want people to go check it out for themselves.
It covers the trial, and the trial was very entertaining. We had a fantastic, I've downplayed the United States Attorney's Office, but the individual prosecutor, Greg Staples, was fantastic, funny, and did a great job of prosecuting both cases. Sorry for the interruption, but I got to give him credit.
Yeah, absolutely. No. Thank you for that. Yeah, no, of course, as you said, it draws from your own notes, the case files, court records, which you didn't get into much now, but that's all still in there. There's a trove of photos from the case in there, too. So you can sort of, you know, see the people that we've been talking about. Links to learn more about all this stuff and pre-order the book will be in the show notes. Really recommend checking it out if you want a rare, detailed look at how counterintelligence actually works inside the U.S. Jim, thanks again for joining us. It's been great to have you.
Thanks. It was a lot of fun. I appreciate you letting me go on and on about stuff, but had sure. fun.
Yep.
Thank you,
Bye.
thanks for listening. This is Secrets and Spies.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com, RiteRug.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com, RiteRug.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com, RiteRug.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com, RiteRug.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
Dakota has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit RightRug.com, RiteRug.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
At Ability Chiropractic, we believe every child deserves to grow up healthy, strong, and connected to the incredible power within their own body. From infants to adults, our doctors specialize in purposeful chiropractic care that restores balance between the brain and body, helping you and your family live and heal the way you were designed to, naturally. Families across Columbus are choosing to build lifelong wellness from the start. Discover what true health feels like at Ability Chiropractic. Schedule your visit today at abilitychiro.com.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit RightRug.com, RiteRug.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right.